Hi, this is Richard Parker with Diomo. Today we're going to discuss the due diligence stage of the business buying process. Every business has secrets. And today we'll really dig into how you can easily and painlessly complete a thorough review of any business and uncover all the issues before you buy it. My expert this month who is here to share his vast knowledge with you is Leonard Moskowitz, and I'll explain to you in a minute why I call him Uncle Lenny. He is, without question, one of the nation's foremost authorities on due diligence. He and I have worked together on numerous transactions, and I can tell you from firsthand experience, he's incredible. He knows every trick that sellers use to fool buyers and has an uncanny ability to get to the real story on any deal. Today we're going to talk about a number of critical issues, including how you can uncover when a seller may have cooked the books, what you need to do specifically during due diligence, the most common problems that sellers try to hide from buyers, how to protect yourself from the business falling apart after you buy it, plus we will have our famous expert hot seat. And of course, there's much, much more. So let's get started. My guest today is Leonard Moskowitz, and he is a serial entrepreneur. He's an absolute expert in due diligence, and he's got a background that lends itself perfectly to what he does every day, and he really is one of the country's foremost experts on due diligence. On behalf of myself and everyone listening, I want to welcome you.
Richard, thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, what is really the definition of due diligence, or the textbook definition of due diligence, and when does it begin formally?
Okay, well, due diligence, it's an investigative process, and it's designed to provide answers to very specific questions, you know, and the questions are developed as one works closely with the selling company. It's actually like a process of reviewing and investigating the statements and representations made by a seller, and it's designed to protect the interests of the buyer by providing, like, reliable, objective information. It's also designed, from my point of view, to determine if there's a potential fatal flaw and the possible impact it may have on the acquisition or the expected investment returns.
So in other words, due diligence is really the time when a buyer is going to have the opportunity to access all of the information from a seller and conduct a detailed review to determine the viability of the business and of course, to validate what has been represented at that point, but to really investigate all components of the business, right?
Definitely.
So,
definitely.
You know, I've always counseled clients that due diligence begins the moment a business becomes of interest to you. In other words, you know, you have to begin gathering information and doing research immediately. However, you know, due diligence is really a specific and standard stage in the business buying process. So when does it, the formal period of due diligence actually begin?
Okay. From my experience, due diligence begins when the buyer and seller sign a contract, when they actually sign the contract for the purchase of the business. Anything prior to that is just talk, and the buyer has no access to any records because it's just a big discussion. When they sign, that's when it begins.
So they could have access to records, in fact, before, but they're getting, you know, complete access at that point. So they sign the contract and then formalized due diligence begins. Okay, that's great. What specific things should a buyer look for initially in the business for sale listings or in the preliminary financials that they might see? For example, if formalized due diligence begins when the buyer and sellers have signed the contract, well, leading up to that point, the buyer has to gain a certain level of comfort with the financials and the business in order to be able to even offer a contract altogether. So, you know, what are certain things that a buyer can do leading up to that formalized period, and what can they review to, you know, provide them with a certain level of comfort and information that they want to move forward with that business?
Okay, well in many instances, the buyers get some sort of financial information from the seller or from the broker. And in this, if they get some profit and loss statements, they should see generally that there's a consistency in revenue, that there aren't major swings in the revenue and the gross profit percentages. There aren't swings. There's no unusual drop or increase in expenses. You know, they should also think how many years the company has been in business. You know, if it's a year and a half, it's a very... it's something to really be concerned with, you know. So in comparing, if they get at least 2 years, and just eye comparing all the numbers to see that things make sense, you
right.
know.
and that and so that that everything looks at least reasonably consistent, or there's a reasonable story behind the numbers. So,
right.
I mean, it would be nice if every business deal was super smooth, or a super smooth process, rather. So how does someone deal with being high-pressured by the broker or owner with tactics such as not getting all the financial information they need, or being bullied into a due diligence period that's too short, for example?
Okay, the best thing is for the buyer to stay out of this, is to let the CPA deal with the broker and the owner, and explain to the owner and to the broker what documentation is necessary and why it's necessary. Because there's always a constraint on the part of either one sometimes to give all the information. As long as you explain to them why you want this and why it's necessary, that begins the communication. As to the time constraints, that also has to be explained to them, because it's not like a 12-hour deal. It takes time. You have to look at the information. And a major point that I always explain to the seller is that, look, you're a willing seller. You want to sell the business, and you have a buyer who wants to buy the business. You've signed the contract. So why be unreasonable and hinder the deal? You have to give us all the documentation we request, or else I can't do the job. The buyer may walk away. So when you explain it in those terms in a very nice manner, because the majority of sellers, they've never sold the business. They don't really know what's involved.
Yeah, it's interesting because I've sold 9 of my companies, and when I tell people, I said, I've given a buyer as much time as they want. I know if a buyer asks me for 3 months of due diligence, he's never going to buy. But if a buyer needs a month, and I've always given as much information, because in my opinion, it's always been, if I've been able to reach an agreement with a buyer, I know I tell the truth. I'm not lying about the numbers. I know that anything that I've represented, I mean, it could be something that I've overlooked, but never intentionally. I know that the financial reports that I've provided are going to be true and accurate. So I know that there's nothing going to be discovered during due diligence that's going to be diametrically opposed to what I've represented, unless the buyer gets cold feet, and that could happen. But I've always felt, I'm going to give them enough time. I'm going to give them enough information to choke on, because if I've already got to a point of reaching an agreement with this guy, I want him to buy. At this point, I want his money. So, but it's very hard. The average seller, like you said, hasn't done this before, or a lot of brokers may want to shove a deal, down the pipeline quickly. But if people get enough time, if a buyer wants to buy and the seller wants to sell and the parties trust each other, no one can stop them from getting a deal done, is the way I sort of look at it.
Mm-hmm.
I received a very pointed question recently in my Ask the Expert column, and the inquiry was this, and I had to laugh. How can I tell if a seller is lying? My knee-jerk reaction would have been, if their lips are moving. Of course, most people are honest, but the fact remains that many sellers will try to hide problems. So how does someone know if the seller is lying about the business and the financials?
Well, that's where the due diligence comes in. There could be an inconsistency in reporting the financial operations when compared over a 3-year period. There may be unrealistic profit margins or expenses in the year the seller is basing his sale of the business on. There could be loss of key employees, and that could be determined by examining the payroll tax returns. A detailed comparison of the customers over a 3-year period will show if there's any loss of customers, which may be detrimental to the whole business. There may be technological changes in the marketplace. The most important area for me, actually, is to spend time with the seller.
And I'm going to talk about that in a minute. I want to, because it's a very interesting tactic that you have, and I want to discuss it in presenting it to buyers as how they could really position this whole due diligence to be successful. So before we get into that. Yeah, we want to get into that, because I actually made a note to myself to make sure that I covered that with you, because I know it's a certain tactic that you use that I think is absolutely splendid. But here's my $1 million question at this point that every buyer needs answered, which is, what are the issues that due diligence is unlikely to uncover?
Well, it's unlikely to uncover what may be taking place in the relationships between the owner and his customers or his suppliers. I always find that's very important. An example I had, we were doing a distributor of cigarettes and candies, and his major account was Winn-Dixie. And everything was going good. His books were fine. Everything was fine. And what had happened, I was finished with the due diligence, and the person from New York was going to purchase the business. And it was 5 o'clock, it was late, I didn't want to get into traffic from West Palm Beach to Fort Lauderdale. So I went across the street and I asked the seller, why don't you come with me across the street, we'll have a drink. And I explained to him how lucky he is, how he's moving to North Carolina with the family and it's going to be great. I said, is anyone else coming with you? He said, oh, my brother. I said, wow, that's really great. What does your brother do? He's the buyer. The buyer for what? Oh, he works at Winn-Dixie. He buys all my product. Well, this would have never, ever, this was pure luck. It wasn't any brains on my part. It just was pure luck. He revealed something we would never have found out. Well, needless to say, the deal never went through.
Well, of course, and there's a case of relationships, and oftentimes it's not even, I mean, that's sort of staggering that it would be to that extent. And oftentimes the relationship is not personal with a, let's say, a buyer. There's no hanky-panky going on. In other words, you know, the owner of the company is not paying off the buyer, but it may be a relationship that's gone back for 15 or 20 or 25 years, and they just have such a comfort level with one another, or the supplier has with the retailer. It may not even if they've had buyers that changed, he's become like a fixture, you know, at this particular retailer. And someone else walking in could, you know, they're up against the wall of you know, comfort and a personal relationship that they could never get past. It's really, really interesting. So, I mean, obviously every business has secrets, and there are almost always certain things that, you know, the seller simply does not want the buyer to uncover. And there's a perfect example. He didn't tell the buyer. It was, you know, sort of at the 11th hour of the deal. And they may not be forthcoming in disclosing these real problems. I mean, and that's every buyer's concern, and justifiably so. So let's dig into these potential red flags, and more importantly, you know, share with our listeners how they should deal with them. And for all our listeners, this is one section where you really want to focus and take notes. I'm sure you've seen some crazy things over your career. And this example with the distributor of the confectionery items and tobacco products is a perfect example. Tell us the wildest incident you ever uncovered while conducting your due diligence on a business for a buyer.
Well, it's hard to focus in on one particular thing because each one is important. There's no such thing, in my mind, as the wildest thing. I mean, I've had instances where there were false tax returns prepared.
Amazing.
Completely false tax returns, where owners deposited their own money in order to increase sales, okay, and the profit. And people would say, well, why would they do that? Well, in many instances, they do that, and even though they're paying an additional tax at the end of the year, they always have 3 years to file amended returns and blame their, you know, and just say just they made a mistake, it wasn't recorded.
It's a very interesting because the genesis for me getting into the publishing of the years of consulting that I've done and led to, you know, the courses that we've since published and the CDs and seminars, etc., all were a result of a due diligence gone bad. I shouldn't say a due diligence gone bad. I should say a due diligence gone good. It really uncovered the mess, and it was very similar. This was a guy who was taking from Peter to pay Paul. He was taking from his secondary business, and I only found out by accident because when looking through the sales like crazy, and I've been doing this for a long time and understand and did a good part of my own due diligence in tandem with two accounting firms that I had doing it. But one of the things that I noticed is that his sales on Tuesdays always were higher than the rest of the week. In this one particular business, which had very little seasonality, and couldn't understand it. And then I parked my car outside the guy's place and realized that he owned a couple of other businesses, coin laundries, in fact, and he used to do his collections from all the coin laundries, but his deposits on Tuesdays and one other day in the week. So what he used to do is take from those businesses and put it through this company. The last year, he had done that in an effort to build up the sales, and I caught him doing it. There was no, you know, there was perfect, right?
It was the due diligence gone good. Yeah.
It was the due diligence gone bad. But caught him sort of in the act. And it's only by looking at some of the things. So, you know, some of the, you talked about, I mean, you found someone falsifying tax returns, right?
Oh, well, falsifying tax returns, depositing their own money, which is why you go through the bank statements, right. You look for even deposits. You know, a lot of times they do it, but they're not so smart about it,
right?
You see, I had another instance, which I always ask for now, is a big lawn maintenance company, and their cost of sales, which in a certain area seemed to be too low. And from the accountant, I got a copy of the owner's credit card statement. And on the credit card statement, there was about $65,000 of purchases that related to his business, which, again, there was another example, which he didn't charge the business. And again, people say, well, but why would he pay more taxes? Well, he's only paying more taxes in the beginning. He'll file an amended return. We always file amended returns. And if it's legitimate, there's no problem. In the meantime, he got on that $65,000 or $45,000 three times the selling price.
Right, because there's no cost of goods associated
yeah,
with it.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, the biggest job we ever had, a man made all the canvas coverings for all the boat shows in Miami, Fort Lauderdale, West Palm Beach. And again, it was, oh, it's a tax return, everything is clean and everything like that. And his problem was he was always reluctant to give me all the information. And right away, that started me suspicious. Well, make a long story short, when we analyzed all his accounts, he was doing business with the school board with tents. And his business was leasing out tents. Well, it looked like on the school board, he sold them the tents of over $225,000 without a cost attached to it. Okay? That $225,000 came to the bottom line. So, again, you have to be careful with everyone. They're going to cook the books. They're going to make everything fine. And they think no one will find it.
Right, but it's not, of course, it's not in every case. It's just having the ability to know that it is. You know, that
oh, yeah,
are,
yeah.
It's not everybody. It'll, most people are honest. It's just having the wherewithal to be able to uncover these problems.
Yeah, oh, exactly. I mean, I could tell you a number of stories where everything worked out just fine.
And most of them are the cases.
And most of them are.
And most of the time, if there's a mistake, the seller doesn't even know about it. Something that an accountant or an administrative person or a controller did incorrectly. One thing I do want to point out is, as it relates to tax returns who are based in the United States, there's a form that you can get a seller to sign called the 4506 form,
correct,
which it gives them the right to get the front page of either a business or personal tax return directly from the IRS. So, you know, people are not going to falsify their tax returns and report too much revenue and then submit it to the IRS knowingly in most cases.
Mm-hmm.
So what you do is you get the seller to sign this particular form, and then you could submit it to the IRS and they'll send you a copy of the front page of their tax return, personal or business, and you could just verify that that's in fact the form that they filed, because it's very easy for someone to give you false tax returns and ones that they've never filed. The one thing that I've learned, though, is when you give a seller this 4506 form to sign, if they sign it willingly, you don't even have to submit it to the IRS.
Right.
It's only if they don't sign it that you have a problem. Okay, so let's move on a little bit. Every buyer that I've ever met, and there have been tens of thousands of them, is worried about the seller cooking the books. Now, we alluded to that earlier, but you know, is it fair to say, you know, instances happen where sellers will cook the books? It's not every deal.
Oh,
but
no.
It does happen. I mean,
no.
If you were to guess, if you were to look at 100 businesses, how often does that happen?
I would say maybe 10% of the time.
So, but 10% is still a big number,
obviously. And to the person buying the business, it's a major thing. You know,
it's a major thing, right.
It's his lifestyle.
So how does someone uncover that? They go through the checks and balances that you've just, you know, alluded to? Or is it do you see it very quickly, something doesn't seem right?
Well, generally, as soon as I look at the set of financial statements and breakdown of sales, right away I may tell my wife, this isn't going to go. There's something wrong. But then I have to go through the whole process of the bank statements, of the canceled checks, of all the percentage relationships, to see that just because I think it's wrong doesn't mean it is wrong. There may be viable reasons as to why it's correct, that everything is fine, you know. So you have to have an ability to see what's behind the numbers.
It's great. And then now many small businesses have unreported income. You know, sort of the famous seller takes the seller aside and gives him the wink, wink, and says, by the way, you know, there's a lot more money coming in here than sort of you see on those returns. And I have my own feelings related to unreported income. But, I mean, what I want to discuss right now is if a business does have that unreported income or cash sales for the technical term, can these ever be accurately determined? And if so, how?
Okay. They can be determine with a degree of accuracy. A typical case may be the restaurant business, okay? They all have unreported income. It's normal in the business, okay? What it is, you work backwards. You check what they're purchasing. And in a particular restaurant business, there's a certain gross profit percentage for beverage, a certain gross profit percentage for food. Now, is it an exact science? No. But if based on their costs, their sales should be, let's say, $1 million, and they're only reported $800,000, well, you know, somehow it is, it's maybe a $200,000 swing. But based on their costs, if they've only reported $800,000 and it only shows they should have $800,000, well, then it appears that there isn't any cash. So in many cases, you have to work backwards from a cost basis up. It's not an exact science, but it gives you a feel of to what's going on when you check their costs and their gross profit.
It's interesting because I once had someone in this industry tell me that, you know, reconstructing cash sales is like a three-legged stool. If you have two legs of the stool, you could usually figure out the third. You know, and it was very interesting, but not every owner wants to disclose cash sales because they're worried about, you know, the buyer sort of ratting them out or whatever. But, you know, my opinion related to cash is something that you alluded to very earlier, which is you can sort of accurately do it. I've always been of the opinion that, you know, if the seller can't prove it, you can't pay for it because you never, it's always going to be a guess. Even if you think it's going to be somewhat accurate, it is always going to be a guess. And the truth of the matter is that sellers of a business, if they've been stealing this money and not paying taxes for X number of years, they got the benefit of not paying the tax department for all those years. They can't expect to get it again on a multiple when selling the business. Like, you can't sort of suck and blow, you know? You can't inhale and exhale at the same time.
Right,
and so
right.
And a very good argument can be made. And I'm very much of the opinion that if they can't prove it, you can't pay for it. Because you don't know that it exists.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so it's very hard because, you know, sellers have in their mind, well, I take, you know, the other part of the equation is that, you know, they may be taking in all this cash. Yeah, there may be another $200,000 or the difference between the $800 and $1 million, but they're, you know, they may be paying suppliers cash or they may be paying employees cash.
Oh,
I mean,
that,
it's like a whole buffet of unknowns,
oh, yeah.
Of moving parts.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, very,
yeah.
Very difficult to nail down.
Because in many times they never tell you the cash payouts.
Oh, right, exactly.
You know, now, in terms of employees, especially like in beauty parlors and stuff like that.
Well, it's one of the questions I want to ask is, you know, often we see it here, and especially, you know, you and I are based in Florida. You see it in some of these jurisdictions mm-hmm. where they have, you know, illegal workers.
Right.
I mean, how do you... You know they're there. I mean, you go to the business and you just sort of have this sense that some of these people... How do you uncover that?
Okay. The first thing I always get is a list of the employees. And it's a verifiable list, meaning the buyer to go out and actually see the number of employees. Say if they have 10 employees, you get a list of the employees. Then you get a copy of the payroll tax returns and a copy of the W-4 forms that each employee is supposed to fill out that has his name, his address, his dependents, and everything. And when you put it all together and you see there's only 5 legitimate and the other 5 don't exist, really. That's how you uncover the illegals. And in many times, people in the lawn maintenance, pool maintenance business, they'll tell you. They'll tell you. This is what they do. Then it's up to the buyer. Majority buyers don't want to get involved in that. And foreign buyers definitely not, you know. So then there have to be adjustments made for putting them on the books, what the price will be, what the additional payroll taxes
right.
will be.
Now, you say it's a good point because they're putting them on the books. Sometimes they can't put these people on the books, so they have to hire new people. There's the cost associated with that, the time, the lag, and also, you know, increased expenses. If you're paying someone $6 an hour illegally, and now it's going to cost you $9 with everything legally,
right.
I mean, that's an additional cost to the business. And oftentimes, you know, you have to negotiate with the seller to stay on extra time to help recruit these people. And sometimes it's just too much of a big mess. Right, of moving parts.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And you just walk
but
away.
But it's easy the way you walk through how
yeah.
people can uncover it. In our program, we tell people they need to separate incidents from catastrophes. What I mean by that, there's certain issues that are going to be minor issues that they could deal with. It's part of the process. There's other issues that are, you know, either enormous catastrophic incidents It'll cause them to walk away from the deal, or they may have to renegotiate or readdress. But no business is perfect, and there's always going to be blemishes. So in your opinion, what is an incident that a buyer may uncover or is a common incident that you come across, but you should forget about, versus a major issue or catastrophic incident that they, you know, that they should consider a deal breaker? And I understand everybody is different, but you know, sort of on a in general terms.
A lot of buyers, they tend to focus on the small items, you know, and you have to like hold their hand, because like if they lost a few small accounts, if there's a reduction in revenue, maybe of 5 to 10%, these are not major incidences. There is still a company that's been in business, one or two people leaving who are not significant in the business. Again, it's not a major incident. A major issue may be the termination of a contract with an account that accounts for 30-40% of the business.
That's a catastrophe versus that, the other stuff being, let's say, minor incidents.
Yeah, exactly, because that's going to change the makeup of the company, you see. Or if there's a manager who runs the place and has been there 20 years and he's leaving, that could be considered a catastrophe, because that'll change the workings of the company, you see? So it's just seeing what's important, what's not, and holding the buyer's hand to let them walk away from the unimportant things and not get bogged down in it.
I like the way you define it as well, as to what it basically could have a material impact on the business, positive or negative. You know, those sort of get lumped into the bucket of catastrophes versus, you know, it's like if a guy's buying a local sub shop, and the sandwich maker leaves, I mean, they're going to have 400 sandwiches makers over the next 3 years, right? Right. But if they happen to be a guy who owns four sub shops, and the manager, the guy who, you know, takes care of all four and runs around, if he leaves, I mean, that's a serious guy to have to replace.
Correct.
Okay. So if you uncover one of these catastrophes, what do you do? I mean, do you just walk from the deal?
No. I immediately arrange for a meeting with the buyer and the seller and the brokers, and to discuss the situation. Let's have a meeting, put it on the table, determine what the problem is, address it, and let's come up with suggestions on how to solve it.
Great. So, in other words, if there's these issues, you get everybody to the table, and some are resolved. Well, everything is resolvable. It's a matter of whether or not people could live with the resolution.
Yeah, exactly.
But the goal is to, you know, put a halt on the process of what you're doing in due diligence. Say, listen, we need to regroup. We've uncovered something that is, you know, so significant that it changes the whole, you know, complexity of the deal, and we need to get that out into the open and resolved before we can move forward. So in other words, bring everybody to the table and come up with a resolution. I think it's a great, great suggestion. And this is really great stuff, and no doubt will help a ton of people. Let's look at the overall review of a business for a moment. I'd like to ask you a few questions about how to properly prepare for and conduct the analysis of a company. And one thing I absolutely love, which I apologize about stopping you from expanding upon earlier, is, you know, I love that you, you know, one of the things that you do for your clients is to meet with the seller either for lunch or an informal get-together. And I think the example that you used earlier about the confectionery distributor, I mean, that wasn't even planned. But you always take a seller, as I recall, you remember you telling me, you'll take a seller to lunch, or you'll go meet, if you happen to be working late, you'll go grab a pizza with the guy or whatever, and sort of in an informal setting. And tell our listeners why you do that and some of the things that may have come out from it. But really, what is your agenda in doing that? Because you're not just looking to have a pizza with the seller.
No. You see, I find from my experience with people who have been in business, they're proud of the fact that they're in business. And when you meet with them, first of all, you're explaining that, in a sense, they sometimes think the CPA is the enemy. And you're explaining that you're not the enemy. You want to make a deal because there's a willing buyer and a willing seller. But then what happens, and I also explain the documentation I need and why it's essential to the business. But then the thing I do, I ask them about themselves, how they started their business, how they make money, who their family is, and they never stop talking. And the thing is, you just have to listen. You can't butt in. And they talk and talk and talk, because everybody likes to think they were the best, this is the best business, and they're the king of the mountain.
And they're very proud of what they've accomplished.
And they're proud. And I tell them, it's fantastic. I mean, you've accomplished something from nothing.
And it's interesting, because I guess what, you know, you're hired by a buyer, You're working for the buyer. You're explaining to the seller the documentation that you need and trying to explain to them again that they're not the enemy. But the truth of the matter is your agenda is real simple, which is, you know, you're getting the seller to lower their guard. You know, I mean, and they are going to disclose stuff to you, and they won't see you as the enemy. But as the more and more they talk, and it's an informal setting, I mean, it's a brilliant strategy I can't term it any other way but to say they're lowering their guard.
But, well, I have to give you one example of this, of what happened. I'm with the seller, and I'm asking him, how do you make money? I mean, other than selling like this, he said, well, and I'm telling him I was in the motion picture theater, so we had a lot of cash, and I'm giving him a feeling of, like, comfort, you know, like I'm on that level with him. And he whispers, he pulls me aside, he forgets he's talking to me, pulls me aside, he says, well, there was this gray market in cigarettes. He was a tobacco distributor. I said, what's the gray market? A truck used to pull up with all the stamps, with all the legal things. We sold the cigarettes, and it lasted for 6 months. Now, it happened, that was the period of time, the year, in which we were doing the due diligence. I said, so did it account for much? Maybe 5%. I told him, probably count 5% of your business. He said, no, what are you talking? It was like 20% of my business. I said, so is that going to continue? No, we lost it, which is, we were into the next year already. Well,
note to self.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Now, he told me something I would never know, because the gross profit percentages, they're off 2, 3, 4%.
Yeah, but there's big money in that confectionery and tobacco business. The volume, the margins are slim, but the revenues are enormous typically in those companies.
Right, exactly. So
if you get something that you at absurd margins, I mean, it really impacts your bottom line.
Oh, you know, no question. So when you get to them and you listen and you're excited, they tell you a lot. And then if you need information, again, if you need more documentation, sometimes it gets the broker a little annoyed if you go direct, because a lot of times the broker wants you to go through him, make everything formal. And I just rather just speak to the owner. He knows me.
Right.
I had lunch with him, or I had coffee with him, or something, you know, and they're very happy to give the information, because I'm like I'm his friend, and I'm excited for him. I tell him, this is so great. You're finally reaching the epitome. You're selling your company. You're going to retire. You'll play golf. You'll do whatever you want to do. I mean, you've reached the pinnacle. I said, guys like you, I look up to. And man, there's nothing like that, saying that to.
And they're ready to move. It's funny because, you know, you talk about, you know, them disclosing information. I always tell people when, you know, you want to find information on about the competition or anything like that, the best thing to do is you call and you ask to speak to the salespeople, because salespeople can't shut up. They think they're making a sale. And it's very often the owners of a company are, you know, very often a sales mentality, especially in a smaller company. And you're right. You're stroking their ego in the right place and getting them to disclose stuff to you and you know, talking about it. And I know you're a sincere guy and you are sincerely happy for their success and what have you, but the information that you're able to elicit from them is unbelievable.
Right.
So it's really, you know, I think if our people, you know, our listeners started telling their accountants to go out for lunch with the seller, at first they think they're crazy, but when they understand their job is to find out the information on behalf of the buyer, it's an unbelievable tactic. I love it. What documents does a buyer and you need to conduct the proper due diligence? Maybe, you know, sort of run us through, you know, the top few related to it. Checklist.
I prepare a document request checklist, and the basic documents are for a 3-year period, all the bank statements, the general ledger, insurance policies, sales tax returns, federal tax returns, all sorts of licenses, a list of all the employees with their job description, payroll tax returns, the calculation of owner benefits for a 3-year period. In effect, it's everything that relates to the business from the time they open until they close, and all the pieces of paper that flow through, you're examining some portion of them.
So that typically, if a buyer finds a business that he or she's interested in, initially the seller broker won't provide some detailed financials. You know, so at the very least, you know, when you're talking about information that they do need, you touched upon earlier getting some financial statements that'll give them enough information. Of the checklist that you provided, is it fair to assume that between, what the broker may give them, the internal P&Ls that they may get. I mean, that's enough for someone to initially get an idea of the overall financials of a company, obviously before they commit to a complete, you know, bulletproof valuation or agreement. I mean, is that enough information? They can compile enough of a reasonable or get enough of an idea related to a valuation?
Yeah, definitely.
Wonderful.
Definitely.
So how can the average person with no financial background have enough skill in reading the financials, balance sheet, P&Ls, etc., in order to see the trends, pitfalls, potential hidden items, and real fiscal picture early on? I mean, you know, is it they're just looking, they want to just get a general consensus? Is that what you're guiding them to do? Again, and it's early on in the process.
Yeah, well, I'm not guiding them to do anything, because the fact is the average person doesn't have the training.
He has no clue.
He has no clue.
Right.
I mean, I come across, they check this, they check that, they check nothing. That was the bottom line. They should use the services of their accountant.
And one of the things we talk about shortly is getting into the accountant and how important it is in the accountant's role. But let's for a second, before we get into that, we've been talking a lot about the buyer's perspective. So tell me, you know, what's due diligence from a seller's point of view? I mean, I know, having sold a number of businesses and working with sellers, representing sellers, I mean, my take on it is, you know, sort of they're panic stricken. Even if they have nothing to hide, they're panic stricken, because this is very often the last hurdle. You know, it's the last step in the process separating them from their exit strategy. You know, they're nervous, of course. So, but maybe, you know, in your experience, you've met with infinitely more sellers and whatever. You know, how do they look at due diligence?
Oh no, they're concerned. They're concerned about releasing their financial records and company information.
Even if they have a non-disclosure, they have a deposit.
It doesn't matter.
They're still worried.
They're really concerned, and they, not only to the buyer, but then to me. He has, of course, the seller has no assurance that the deal's going to go through, so he's apprehensive about everything. And this release of information really gets him upset. Even though we sign a non-disclosure agreement, I sign a confidentiality agreement with the seller to assure him that the information just stays within the confines of the buyer and that. So it's a valid thing that the seller is concerned with, and you have to hold his hand.
And also, not only hold on, you have to be sensitive to that. I mean, think a buyer, you know, a seller's biggest concern is always going to be confidentiality, and it's understandable, and it gets to the due diligence. So, I mean, appreciate that you're saying that despite the fact that there could be an agreement, despite the fact that there could be a deposit, despite the fact that the buyer's provided their own personal financials, and despite the fact that the buyer's gone down the road with the seller, they've got an agreement, the buyer's incurred expenses, the seller is still worried about it from a standpoint of, you know, A, the deal may not go through, but also from confidentiality. So it's important to remain sensitive to that fact. I think that plays very well, by the way, to, you know, the idea that you take people, you know, by the hand and you meet with the sellers and give them a comfort level. You know, most small business purchases have significant amount being paid for goodwill, especially service businesses. You know, and goodwill, as I like to define it for our listeners, is the amount of the purchase price less the value of the tangible assets like machinery and equipment, desks and chairs, and easily identifiable intangible assets. Okay, so it's the difference between the purchase price and those hard assets. That's what makes up goodwill. But goodwill is something where, you know, a lot of people have trouble valuing, because it's a completely arbitrary number. So when you look into the valuation of a business, and we're going to get into some of the issues more extensively later on, but I like people to understand, because they're going to look at a lot of businesses where goodwill represents the biggest percentage of the purchase price. How do you get somebody, a buyer, comfortable when they're looking at this and they're saying, you know, well, I'm only paying X for the assets, and the assets are this, the inventory is this, and they can't get over the hump of knowing goodwill, because it does represent the biggest portion of the sale in most cases. How do you sort of dig down from that, you know, like in the due diligence? How do you sort of, you know, let's say, justify it?
Well, I find that it's not so much justifying anything, because assets are only good with the income they produce.
They're only a means to drive revenue.
That's all it is. So if the business is being sold for $1 million and there's $200,000 in assets, machinery and equipment, or $800,000, if it doesn't make money, they're useless.
Right. I mean, if you had the business that had $800,000 in equipment and made $100,000 versus the business that has $200,000 in equipment and makes $500,000, give me the $200,000 worth of equipment business any day.
Exactly. And the difference being the goodwill, I mean, you value the assets on a current value. And if they come, say, to $300,000 and the business costs $1 million, the difference of $700,000 is part of goodwill. It could be covenant not to complete. It could be client list. You could give it a whole list of different categories. Right. In my opinion, who cares? The only thing it cares is that the goodwill is written off over 15 years and the assets may be 5 to 7 years.
Right. When we're going to talk about that in a second related to tax issue, because that's, you bring up a very, very important point. So in any business purchase, regardless of the size of the company, you need to engage competent professionals. We've just talked a bit about that. You know, most people think of their attorney as their go-to person on the deal. And the fact that, you know, that's really the wrong perception in small business purchases. Now, don't get me wrong. Attorneys play, you know, a very important role, but it's usually limited to drafting of agreements and specific legal issues that the buyer needs to be aware of and protected from. Now, most attorneys have never owned, let alone bought a company. And so practically speaking, their input is really limited to the legal end of the deal. And of course, it's important. I don't want to discount that at all. But accountants, on the other hand, are what I call the nitty-gritty advisors. You know, a good one will really roll up their sleeves and dig into the business. And they play a huge role in the business review, and they clearly have a more significant or challenging role, if you will, than an attorney in a typical small business purchase. And so I want to get your feedback on the role that they play in a deal. You know, and personally, I go nuts when I hear someone suggesting they're going to do their own financial due diligence, or they're going to hire their brother-in-law, the controller at the local hardware store, to help them dissect the business's financial. And it's common to hear that. So please, please tell our listeners why it is so important to hire an experienced accountant to assist in the due diligence review.
The CPA is the only one that really is going to know about the business, its accounts, its nuances. He's the only one directly involved with you in the whole process, from beginning to end. And he's the only one that has your best interests at heart and is concerned about you. The attorney prepares the agreements based on the due diligence results, and it's nothing more or less. And when they say they have a brother who could do something, or an uncle, it's a waste of time and effort on their part. Because I always explain to the buyer, look what you're paying for the business. The due diligence, it's an insurance policy. That's what you're taking out. So if you're trying to save money on the due diligence, that's the last place you want to save money, because right, that's going to serve as the basis for your purchase or you're not purchasing.
And it's like the final frontier, you know? So tell us, you know, what specific things does an accountant do during due diligence? Now, I know you do some things that are very different from other people. I'm sure there's some accountants that do other things that you don't do for whatever reason. But in general terms, you know, you're looking to validate the numbers that the seller has represented. There's certain checks and balances. But what is really your role during due diligence? I mean, your agenda going into due diligence is to accomplish what?
Okay, my agenda is to, like, thoroughly investigate all the financial information for a 3-year period plus the current year-to-date period. Okay. And I examine and I prepare schedules relating to the 3 years' tax returns, the profit and loss, the owner benefits, and the verification of deposits, the insurance expenses, payroll taxes, rent. In effect, I'm examining to varying degrees all the revenue and all the expenses that appear on the tax return and in the books, okay? And then after that, it's preparing pro forma financial statements going forward, preparing the cash flow projections as to the amount of working capital that may be necessary, preparing different break-even schedules, showing the potential buyer if there's a drop in business versus an increase in business, what he could look forward to under varying circumstances. And that's really what I do during the due diligence.
So in other words, you know, the decision as to whether or not they buy the business based upon everything remaining equal, well, that's a pretty easy decision. It's, you're going to take them through some of the, you know, it's not just blue sky. There's, you know, cloudy skies as well, and you have to consider the different scenarios. So you're digging in to see if there's problems below the surface as well. I mean, is that
correct?
Because, you know, numbers are numbers, and I always say numbers don't lie, people lie. So you're looking at these numbers. I mean, are you digging, you know, scratching below the surface to see what's there?
Each time I look at a number, I think of what's behind that number. How did that number come into being? You know, because otherwise you're just writing down numbers.
Yeah, it's just a number is a number, right?
Right, and it's relationships. You're looking at deposits. You're looking at deposits, not just seeing deposits.
Very good. Yeah, it's a good way of putting it. So now, will you compile evaluation of a business as part of your process? Because it's sort of a sticky point. If a buyer comes to you and says, I found this business I like. I put in an offer. They accepted my offer. I got your name from Joe Schmo. He says you're the guy to do the due diligence. So now contracts in place, valuation's done, everything's done. I mean, are you going now to do, would you do a valuation and say to this guy, hey, listen, you're completely overpaying for this business. Or you're going and you're getting engaged to the work, engaged for the work that they've asked you to do to validate the numbers that been represented.
Yeah, well, my experience is that the valuation belongs in the hands of someone who was skilled in that process. That's not my business, the valuation. From my perspective, as long as the buyer and seller are in agreement on a price and the representations are in line, that's all that matters.
It's interesting because, you know, I go through this argument all the time with prospective clients of mine. I never go through this argument with clients of mine because clients might understand the difference. You know, get people who are looking to buy a business, they have this completely incorrect perception of what they do, what an accountant does, mm-hmm. what an attorney does. And they don't understand that ultimately the valuation of the business falls to the buyer. It really does. Yeah. I mean, it falls to the buyer because no matter who compiles a valuation, even if they hire an outside firm to do it, they have to decide if they're prepared to pay that price. You know,
exactly.
So, you know, the attorney gives them advice and they think going in, the attorney is going to negotiate the deal. Well, you know what? Getting an attorney, and some of my closest friends are attorneys, and do a lot of my work is with attorneys. But to me, getting an attorney to negotiate your deal is like giving my six-year-old son a can of gasoline, a book of matches, and a bag of dynamite. I mean, you know what?
Right.
The chances are pretty good there's going to be an explosion. You know, they're not well-versed in that. That's not an attorney's role, nor is it the accountant. So,
right.
So you're, you know, that's not your position. You're just, you know, you want to make sure that they know what they're getting, right? And they're buying, what they're buying or allegedly buying is correct, related to the numbers.
Yeah, I mean, the price for anyone is what a willing buyer is willing to pay. It's not my business what they're willing to pay. And whether, like you say, whatever the valuation is, it still doesn't matter. It's what they're willing to pay.
What they're willing to pay. And it's interesting because, you know, I always like to talk about, you know, what is your role in it, compiling a valuation for clients? We're pretty much on the same page. But, you know, what questions should a buyer ask an accountant, or what can they be sure to, you know, that they're hiring the right one? Your specialty is due diligence. Another guy is tax. Now, most accountants graduated. They did auditing in order to graduate. So fundamentally, they can all do a due diligence. But someone who's not in our backyard and can't hire you necessarily, although I'm sure you'll do work across the country, what are three questions that you would suggest a buyer asks an accountant to determine if they're the right guy to do the due diligence for them on a particular business?
Well, first they should ask for their experience. How long have they been CPAs? Secondly, I think they should ask if they've ever owned any businesses along the way.
Great question. Great question.
And then they have to meet with the accountant. Like whoever calls me, before I do anything, I meet with them. I never discuss anything over the phone other than let's meet for coffee, let's meet in the office. And I never meet in an office. I always meet at a Starbucks, at a coffee shop. Of course, it's informal, we get to know each other, and they have to have a good feeling because you may be the smartest guy, you may have the most experience, but it just doesn't feel right, you know?
Right. And, it, you know, one thing that I tell people, and I'd like your opinion on, when someone asks me, could you give me a list of referrals for accountants in a certain area, I always give them three. I give them my opinion, say, this person, he specializes in this, she specializes in that, but the truth is you've got to go meet three of them. And make sure that you get along with them, that you like them, that you trust
exactly.
them, that you feel that they're looking out in your best interest, that you're finding your own version of their Uncle Lenny. But give me an idea of what parts of the due diligence process does a typical accountant do versus other areas where a buyer needs to perform on their own.
Okay, I always have this discussion with buyers because a lot of buyers don't actually get involved in the business. And I tell them, my function is to perform a financial function. Your function is to perform an operational function, to see the operations, to go out with the owner, to see what makes the business tick. And that's it. One is financial, one is operational.
It's a very good delineation of the responsibilities. One of the things that people have to be prepared to do and understand is accountants have certain times of the year where they're completely out of control and neurotic. you know, when it gets to tax season, when it gets to the quarter end, when it gets to filing the extended returns, I guess, in October or whatever. I mean, you can't speak to an accountant. They tear out their hair. I still don't understand it because, like, these are supposed to be intelligent people. You know, year after year after year, I keep hearing my accountant friends say they're out of control in April. You know, at some point you learn to adjust or structure your business, train your clients, whatever. It doesn't happen. It's year after year. They go completely crazy. But, you know, from a timing perspective, it's important that a buyer keeps their CPA informed right from the beginning. So don't wait. In other words, I'm sure you advise people, don't wait until you've got a contract to go find an accountant. Find one early on. You may only use them in a year when you find the business. But nail down who you're going to use and find out if there's certain times, if they're going to be out of town on vacation or they have a daughter's graduation. Or, you know, last week we spoke, you were going to Arizona to visit, I guess, your granddaughter for a birthday or whatever, right? I mean, but there's certain people have vacations, but there's also the seasonal peaks and valleys associated with, you know, the accounting industry of tax season that they have to be cognizant of. You know, and the other thing that I suggest to people is when they get the initial checklist, you're going to give them a checklist or you're going to give the seller a checklist or the other broker, but you give the group, the other side, a checklist. Now, they prepare those documents. I always counsel people, you know, prepare, when you get those documents back from the seller, organize them yourself for the accountant. The first day that the accountant's coming in, even though you've hired the accountant, organize the tax returns, organize the bank statements, go through them, make sure they're not missing November of 2007, so you lose a day with the accountant because he can't complete it. And the truth of the matter is, if the numbers don't make sense to you, the buyer, initially, chances are they're not going to make sense to the accountant. Like if you can't at least look and say, he's got the tax returns, he's got the bank statements, if all of it is a big mess to you, it's probably going to be a big mess to the accountant. So try to organize it for them as well.
Right. Yeah, I think that's a great technique to use because a lot of buyers don't want to get involved. They just sign an agreement, but they don't get involved.
And when you're saying they don't want to get involved, you're saying they sign an agreement with the seller, and then it's like they don't want to get involved in finding out if it's a good business, like or validating the numbers. They say, here, you know, Lenny, do the work.
Right. You do it. And then when I'm going down to pick up the records and speak concerning the financial records, I always tell the buyers, come with me. Come with me. You may pick up something that you didn't pick up before in the discussion, you see? And be part of it. They're always on any emails that I send out. They always know what's going on because a lot of them figure, oh, he'll do it, and it's finished.
You know, it's interesting because obviously you're not dealing with a lot of my clients. Because, you know, we make it abundantly clear in all of our materials to people. Look, this is the process from beginning to end. You have to be completely involved in. There is nothing involved with buying a business that's over anybody's head who has a normal IQ and a desire to work. This is all pretty straightforward stuff.
True.
We're not sending men to the moon here. But it becomes overwhelming and impossible to understand if you don't pay attention to it. Because you slip up because it's a process. Mm-hmm. And you can't jump from step one to step eight. And so it's critical because those are the buyers that you refer to who don't get involved. Those are the buyers that can't pull the trigger.
No.
You know, they can go through the due diligence. They're looking for you to say to them, buy or don't buy.
Exactly right.
And that's not your job.
Exactly.
Okay. Nearly every accountant I know sits on the fence when and it leads to my next question. When the inevitable question comes from a buyer and they turn to you and ask you, if you were me, would you buy this business? So, first of all, why is that? I don't know why they're looking to you to answer that question, but how do you even answer that?
Well, it's true. They all ask it. They all want to be held, have their hands held, and they're nervous, and they want assurance. I can't give an opinion as to buying the business because the purchase is like, it's a very personal one for the buyer, and his thoughts and his ideals apply to him. And I tell them what I would or wouldn't do is no reflection on what you should do. We're two different people, so only you could make that decision. I could give you all the financial information, but the decision to buy or sell, it's your deal.
I remember once being in a transaction, you were actually the accountant, and you won't even remember, but I remember the buyer asking you the same question. And at that point, you said, look, I've given you the facts of the business. If you recall, the owner benefits were offered by about 40%. There was a contract to be negotiated in 3 months. Didn't even know if that was going to materialize. The lease on their premises where they'd spend all their advertising, they were changing. The owner was a whack job. I mean, I won't even mention their name, but there was sort of all these negatives that were leading up to it. And I was actually quite surprised that the buyer had continued to keep you engaged through all of these issues that had come up. And he continually asked my opinion and said to him, you know, He kept saying, is it a deal breaker? I said, well, I don't know if it's a deal breaker, but it certainly, you know, it constitutes enough importance that we should sit down with the seller to clarify. And he said, well, you know, I just want to finish off. I think he felt very much that he wanted to have this bank account of problems to go back to the seller to hammer down the price by about 80%. At this meeting, he kept asking, well, what do you think about this? And he'd answer, what do you keep about this? And what do you answer? And there was one after the other were negatives. And he finally said, well, if you were me, would you buy the business? And I remember you saying to him, look, I've answered every one of your questions. We haven't found a positive yet. He said, I think you could answer your own question. And I guess it's a matter. They need the validation.
They need it. Yeah, exactly.
It's very, very interesting. You know, there are some tax and deal issues that most buyers overlook, and sometimes their accountants as well. They're actually pretty straightforward issues. And listeners, make sure you take note of these so you don't overlook them either. Let's see, issue number one. Tell us a little bit about the purchase price allocation and how it can really impact the buyer and the seller.
Okay, from the buyer's point of view, he wants to have as much of his cost allocated to assets.
To hard assets.
To hard assets, to fixed assets. So he could write it off over a period of 5 to 7 years. And the balance of goodwill would be over 15 years. From a seller's point of view, he would like everything allocated to goodwill, so he would pay at a capital gain tax rate. So that's where the discrepancy comes in between buyer and seller as to the allocation of assets.
Great. And then the second issue is, what are some of the tax issues that you can come across in small business purchases that every buyer needs to know? Are there any ones in addition to what you've just discussed?
Well, most of the buyers should only buy assets instead of the stock of any entity, because by buying the stock, there may be contingent or real unrecorded liabilities and all sorts of things that are hidden there. So if they just buy the assets, the biggest question then concerns the allocation of the purchase price.
And that's something you'll work out with the other accountant?
Yeah, and that has to be agreed to, because there's a form that goes with the IRS, and it has to be agreed to with the buyer and seller. But in all my experience, it's always worked out.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's a problem that seems paramount at the beginning. Often people are not familiar with it. I've never seen a deal fall apart because of it.
Yeah.
But so it just gets worked out. And, you know, my advice to buyers or sellers is let your CPA deal with the other CPA, because they're both logical people and they're going to figure out a way
to
make it work. So this is great information. We've now covered preparation, you know, the accountant's role, potential key issues, red flags, and our listeners have heard a ton of powerful ideas they can put to use at once. I mean, it's really great information. But these are all what I call present-day issues. But there's one other looming thread I want you to share with our listeners, and that's how they can uncover and protect themselves from major issues that may only arise in the future. How can someone tell if the business will fall apart or if the customers will stop buying after the owner leaves? In other words, they want some mechanism of protection to make sure the business doesn't go into the toilet after they buy it.
Okay, well, one big area that I'm always involved in is seller financing. I love when a buyer owes money to the seller. That's always his little cushion for things that may come up that weren't disclosed, and at least he has some sort of protection with that. Another thing could be, if there isn't seller financing, there could be a certain amount of money held in escrow for a period of time for the benefit of the buyer, again, in the event something comes up. And it helps if the seller is retained in the business for a period of time as a consultant.
For a meaningful transitional period.
Right.
Great. All right, everyone, I'm excited to get to the best stuff of this session, our expert hot seat. But first, I want to tell you what's coming up in our next CD. Next month, we'll be discussing one of the biggest concerns business buyers have, how to find and choose the right business. And here are a few of the topics that we're going to cover. How to quickly determine what business is right for you. Establishing your personal 5 golden rules and why this is absolutely critical to your success. We'll talk about the single biggest mistake people make when trying to figure out what business is right for them. Also, you'll learn what you can do immediately to help you in the process. You'll also understand why I paid $100,000 for an underperforming upside-down company that everyone said was going bust and somehow managed to turn it into a massively profitable $4.5 million business within 5 years. And of course, there's going to be much, much more. Okay, Uncle Lenny, are you ready for the expert hot seat?
Yes, I am.
Okay. As an introduction to the segment, I always tell our guests that we have only 5 minutes and our listeners expect to be blown away with incredible information from our experts that we interview on these CDs. So there's no additional pressure here. So here goes. I'm going to ask you 4 questions. And question number 1, what are the simplest and most powerful bits of information on the subject of due diligence that you've ever learned, period?
Every seller is guilty of manipulating the owner benefits and financial information until proven innocent. You could never investigate a business enough during the due diligence period.
That's great. So you, and it's nice because they have professionals like yourself to help them do that. So question number two, if our listeners only walked away with what you're about to say right now, and they absolutely had to be successful, what would you tell them?
As a potential buyer, maintain a positive attitude throughout the process. Never give up. Have a vision of where you want to be and what you want to be. Accomplish it. It will come to pass. As everything works out for you, you will be your own boss and walk among the entrepreneurs of the world. And remember, Babe Ruth held the most home runs in a season for many, many years. That same time, he also held the record for the most strikeouts in a season.
Great. Question number three. What are two of the biggest mistakes people make when they are trying to conduct due diligence for a business purchase, and what should they do about it?
Number one is they annoy the seller with a constant barrage of questions. And my opinion is they should be quiet until the results are in and the due diligence completed. And they also look to obtain a bargain by having any initial agreed upon selling price reduced by looking at the smallest items rather than looking at the big picture and thinking in a forward manner.
In other words, not confusing incidents with catastrophes and leveraging
exactly
their real problems into a real discount as opposed to minor problems to just aggravate the seller. And question number four, what is the single biggest thing that you've learned that has helped you as a person to become successful in life?
Well, I treat everyone with the utmost respect, and I always ask questions relating to them. I never look to be a big shot. I'm humble, and I listen twice as much as I speak.
That's why you're everybody's Uncle Lenny. Well, you know, I got to tell you, this has been a great, great session. I told everyone I was excited to host this talk, and you certainly didn't disappoint us. Thank you again for getting together with me today. You've shared some amazing information with everyone, and I look forward to our next interview. I also want to encourage our listeners to contact you for any financial, operational, or due diligence needs that they may have by visiting your website at www.lennymoskowitz.com. That's not Uncle Lenny Moskowitz, that's www.lennymoskowitz.com. Or you can call Lenny directly at 954-632-0195. Again, 954-632-0195. Make my Uncle Lenny your Uncle Lenny. Thanks again. This was great.
Thank you.